If your vibe is the earlier the better, Lowe's early Black Friday deals are a no-brainer. Get up to 35% off select major appliances, and rewards members get free delivery, haul-away, basic installation, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 11/4. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change. LG member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details.
And then immediately we flew to Miami to do some work, start getting ready for the candidates. Should we say that? Are we allowed to disclose that? Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the C-Squared podcast. It's been a while. It's been a very busy start to 2024. Fabi, we haven't talked since the World Rapid and Blitz. We had a couple of episodes dropping, a very interesting one with MVL, a very fun one with James Conti. But right now we're finally back together, and we do have a lot to talk about because a lot of things have been happening in the chess world. There's a big tournament happening right now, Tata Steel. We'll chat about that in just a second, and a lot of other things. But first things first, Happy New Year's, happy 2024. Tell us a bit about what, in fact, we've been doing to start off the year.
Yeah, it's, Happy New Year. I mean, it's been a while since the New Year struck, but yeah, I guess we haven't recorded something in quite a while. I mean, we had, as you mentioned, the big Champions Chess Tour. Everyone got together, and when we spoke to Maxime, we spoke to Canty. Those were fun. Two great guys in the chess world. Mm-hmm. Very interesting talks with them for sure. I mean, there's always a lot of stuff going on in the chess world, as you know, right? It's nonstop events. There's obviously a big one going on right now. Mm-hmm. So Tata Steel, but there's all sorts of online events as always. There was a World Rapid and Blitz, so Magnus won both of those. Kind of incredible achievement, again, as he repeated last year.
Actually, let's review those. Tell us a bit about your experience at the Rapid and Blitz. How was the venue? I saw you were doing some photo shoots at the start of the event. You visiting the town with Levon. I think it was big on social media at some point. How did you enjoy the experience overall? Because obviously there were all these talks about going or not going to Uzbekistan.
Yeah, I finally decided to go, even after all my talk, and probably looked silly to people, all my talk about how it was so difficult to get there. It was difficult to get there, but I did find a way to cut up the trip in a way which made me feel as though I could manage it. And of course, I just wanted to play because it's a big event, right? It's a big chance to win a world championship. I mean, not the main world championship, let's say, but still a very important achievement. Those who have managed to win over the years obviously value that very highly. And those who haven't are trying. So I've gotten silver medal and bronze medal, but I've never gotten the gold medal. And of course, I was trying to do that. This time I didn't get close in either one. Unfortunately, it was all a bit up and down, a bit too up and down. And yeah, I didn't really ever stay at the top. So I managed to, at the end, get near the top, but not really to stay there consistently throughout in the way that you have a chance at medals. And Magnus in the Rapid was, you can't really fault him for anything. I mean, he just basically was the clear leader from start to finish. It was a very smooth performance. And in the Blitz, it was a bit less clear cut, but still he managed to pull through in the end and pretty solidly without even needing a tiebreak. So for me, it was slightly disappointing, I have to say. I at least wanted to fight for medals. You know, if you get a medal, you have a pretty good emotion. Like last time I got the bronze medal in the Rapid, it wasn't like the biggest thrill ever, but I was pretty satisfied with at least the Rapid. Blitz was very up and down. I'm talking about 2022, and this time I didn't even have that like little boost from getting third place or second place. Mm-hmm. And okay, there, my tournament was unremarkable compared to everything else that happened besides Magnus winning. Of course, there was this very, very famous Jan Nepomniachtchi and Daniil Dubov game.
The Dance of the Knights, yes.
Yeah, which ended in a double forfeit, very rare occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
Not unprecedented. It was something that you could actually expect. Because I've seen other examples of this, not at the very highest level, but two players play a game which is decided by whoever's in charge, which is very often the arbiters. I think it usually is arbiters who make this decision, that the game kind of puts chess into disrepute or whatever their terminology is for this. But basically what happens is they decide that the players have not respected the game and therefore don't get the point that is usually shared in a chess game. And that's what happened. It was actually pretty, potentially, you could argue, important for the tournament standings, because if you look at the final standings, well...
Wasn't Dubov like half a point behind Magnus? Basically, in the final standings, half a point? In the final standings, yeah.
Yeah, of course, you can definitely say, well, you know, the tournament goes entirely differently, right?
Of course.
It's that wasn't the end of the tournament. Like, that wasn't the last round. So all sorts of things could have happened, could have changed, depending on that game. But yeah, if you look at the final standings, it's a pretty important half point.
Yeah.
What happened was they kind of agreed to this sort of night, the silly night dance, which is, they said it's a protest sort of against the conditions, against the fact that there was like a 1 hour plus delay.
Yeah.
Due to a totally ridiculous thing. I mean, Andrew Hong was playing Yu Yang Yi. And this is just like the reason for the delay.
Mm-hmm.
And Hong made a move, pressed the clock, but apparently didn't press it hard enough, and his time ran out because he didn't realize that the clock actually didn't start for his opponent. It stayed running for him. And then he claimed that he had pressed the clock, and he filed an appeal. This was all dealt with during the round. So during the middle of the tournament day. So everyone was left waiting for like an hour. There's not much you can do about it. I mean, I think it should have been handled faster because, with all due respect to Andrew, and I think he's a nice guy and I know him a little bit, and it's nothing wrong with filing an appeal if you think that you're in the right. But, unless there's like some video evidence that he absolutely did press the clock and there was a malfunction, which there wasn't, then you have to just like rule against him very quickly.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Because he actually ran out of time. So that's my take on it. Okay. The players were a little bit annoyed. Dubov and Nepo decided to make this little protest, which whatever, it's their choice if they want to make a protest. But I don't think it was very effective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really see the benefit from this, like, hey, you're protesting something. It's not exactly clear what you're protesting, that they took too long for an appeal, protesting that Magnus got a private room or something like that. But this is obviously not going to have any positive effect. It's just a distraction from everything, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to protest, you just say, okay, these things were wrong and I'm sort of complaining officially about it and so on, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I actually talked to Andrew and he was making his case that the clock malfunctioned. I mean, this is a world championship. You should have the measures in place to check these things quickly. I understand there's a lot of boards and it would require quite some resources to, let's say, put cameras on all of the boards. But I mean, I'm sure you can fund, I don't know, fee they can fund, especially for this tournament, and you know, they can take it from one year to the other. I don't know, buy a few webcams and put it next to each and every board. I'm sure it would even turn a profit for them by simply showing the games later on their YouTube. You know, things, very simple things that can be implemented and that can just eliminate this type of protests and this type of situations altogether. It would be very easy to just watch it on camera, see whether it malfunctioned, because I've seen clocks that malfunction, actually. I've seen clocks that if they don't have enough battery, sometimes they don't record the move, or they just simply turn off. A lot of times clocks have turned off in the middle of the game, and then you have to kind of gauge, okay, how much time did I have? How much time do you remember we had? If you don't have the camera going on, then you're not going to be able to be precise. So yes, especially due to the fact that it's such an important event, I feel like we should have these measures in place. We have them for all the private events. We have them for, the GCT events, or, the Champions Chess Tour events. There's always going to be a camera pointed at the board. But at the same time, there's fewer boards in the World Championship. There's 150 boards. Like, how many players were there?
To be honest, I don't remember exactly how many boards there were.
Quite a few.
Yeah, it's quite a few. Quite a few.
Yeah, it's an investment, but I feel like it should be done, especially given, let's say the propensity for these things to happen, especially in Blitz and Rapid.
Yeah, in Blitz and Rapid, anything can happen. It's not like it's anyone's fault. Obviously, Yu Yangyi wasn't at fault. Hong was just arguing his case. Mm-hmm. As I wouldn't have done it personally, because I would think, okay, it's a half point, and then you waste an hour energy, and it's in the middle of the tournament. It's not like at the end when maybe you're fighting for medals. It's like right in the middle, and half point isn't probably going to change your tournament too much, because you'll play someone a bit weaker and you're more likely to get a full point. And so I would have just accepted the decision and moved on. But I understand if you want to fight it, especially if it's a matter of principle to you, you think you're right. Okay, that's your choice as well.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was, there was all sorts of little things during the World Championship that people were talking about. Nothing, I think, too major. Like, we talked about the whole Magnus private room, whatever.
Yeah, those things were a big deal. More or less covered. Where did you spend New Year's?
Well, I went to visit my parents for a little bit after that. That's why I mentioned I kind of found a way to split the trip while also seeing my family for a bit. So it kind of made sense. It was still a long trip, but it definitely made a lot more sense for me like that.
Yeah, seeing you.
And then I came back. Yeah.
I'm feeling old. Every time we were getting the New Year celebration, I remember, staying up until 5-6 a.m. in the morning and partying when I was, 20, and now I barely make it to midnight. Midnight, New Year's, go to sleep type of thing. So yeah. I guess, the world is changing in some regard. But anyway, good start 2024, at least for me. We played the Pan Americans, big intercollegiate event. Mizzou won it. So this was a big deal, obviously, with the program being created only a few years back. And now we're finally winning the Pan Ams. It was a big moment. And then immediately we flew to Miami to do some work. Start getting ready for the candidates. Should we say that? Are we allowed to disclose that?
Yeah, I think so. Why not? We everyone's training for the candidates. That's obvious. So everyone who's playing is nobody's going to skimp. Is that the word?
I'm not sure. Skimp? I've never heard that word. That's an interesting one. Okay,
let's skimp. Look
it up. Skimp.
Expend or use less. Yeah, that's a word.
That's a nice word.
Spend or use less time.
Okay.
Money or material. Yeah, nobody's going to skip out, you could say, on their training. Or at least they shouldn't. Okay, so I've noticed that, I've already played many candidates, so I've trained for many candidates, and I've noticed the difference in my training over the years. And okay, I don't think it's too much of a secret what I can show. Magnus posted his training for a world championship. You basically saw exactly what they were doing, which is probably what most people do.
This was after the world championship. Yeah.
Yeah. It was actually what we were supposed to do, except that ours got released during the world championship. Yeah. But that was actually what we were planning. They at some point filmed our training, and they were okay, it'll be released a few months after the World Championship, and then it got released during. So that was maybe not ideal.
Yeah.
But we saw Magnus, it was like PH is there, Dubov is there, Fresenay, Laurent Fresenay is there.
Jordan.
Who else? Jordan. And they're all kind of lounging around on sofas with their laptops, and then they look for some ideas, and they play blitz games to test their ideas. Magnus plays a lot of blitz games. They get lunch outside, and so on and so forth. That's basically what people do. I mean, it's a bunch of guys who look for ideas on their computer and then test them out to see if they are challenging to face over the board. And then a lot of blitz games because people just find that fun and enjoy playing blitz.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what training very often is.
Yeah, and I feel there's slight differences, obviously. I think Nepo was talking about his camp at some point, and he was mentioning that it was very, you know, professional. Now, Magnus's camp obviously was also geared very much towards sports. Let's say we know that he likes to play sports. We sort of tried to maintain some sort of a balance as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I actually get in better shape when I'm at home, because when I'm at home, I can maintain a very, very strict routine,
mm-hmm.
and like a very relatively heavy training regimen. Like I can work out every day, and I can also, I just have like more time. I don't have to balance out like managing multiple people's work. It is time consuming and also working myself.
Mm-hmm.
I can take a bit more relaxed approach. So when you're at a training camp, it's nice to play sports. So we try to do that, but I would say my training is less intensive than when I'm at home and can actually get into the gym and like do some heavy, because okay, I have the equipment at home.
Yeah,
I don't have the equipment when I'm on the road necessarily. It's much harder to find a really good gym, and it's also time consuming because you know you have to drive to the gym, you have to drive back, and so on. And nutrition is kind of an issue when you're traveling because it's much harder to get like everything that you would have at home, like cooking for yourself and all that. And also you have to deal with like multiple people, so everyone has their own needs.
Yeah, that's actually a big problem for me whenever traveling. And I'm trying to find ways to optimize for that. It's a very silly word that I try to not use too often, but it is optimization, especially when traveling. It's sort of like you have to find the routine on the go. Like you get there and within a day or two maximum, you need to find a routine that works with you and that, you know, maximizes your health benefits as well. Because like, even if you're eating at the best restaurants, you're still going to eat with a lot of salt, with a lot of taste. It's not going to be super healthy food, even if you're eating like at the best restaurants. So it's a very, very tricky problem to solve.
Yeah. Well, for me, it's like restaurants, I don't mind. I know it's not the healthiest, but that's kind of my secondary concern.
Right.
It just mostly I want to like have an abundance of food,
mm-hmm.
and that's nutritious. And if there is like a little bit too much salt or sugar, I mean, you can call it a cheat meal or whatever you want to call it, but it's better than not having nutrition, right? If you're having like kind of dirty nutrition, it's better than not having it at all, which would be my main concern. Which
I don't know, actually. You eat a lot. You eat a lot. That's true. You eat a lot.
That's just my perspective. Like everyone, I think, will have a different perspective on this, especially since everyone has their own goals, and also depending on their body type and their weight, they might have different goals. Like I'm at a very low weight, mm-hmm. and I always have been. So my goals are not to lose weight,
mm-hmm.
And not to like be super clean. Like I'll be super clean at home, and that's easy when you're at home. When you're on the road, it's hard to be super clean, as you mentioned, because you might have to go to restaurants.
Yeah.
And at restaurants, you can't control anything. You don't know what they're cooking with. You don't know their oil. You don't know the amount of salt they're using, as you mentioned, the amount of sugar they use. Obviously, at a restaurant, like their goal is to make the food taste good.
Exactly.
So taste is not really necessarily correlated to health. Like taste very often is correlated to stuff that might not be so healthy. But yeah, it's definitely interesting. But okay, so going back to like training, my first time training for candidates was in 2016. And this was by far, because I was the first candidate I played, by far my least professional training camp
Okay.
by like a huge margin. It was like 1 week, maybe a bit longer, I don't know, maybe 8 days, maybe 9 days, with Rustam Kazımjanov, with Lawrence Trent. And we invited one, Lawrence was my manager at the time. And we invited one guy who was not part of like the main team, but very strong player, Maxime Bouchard-Legrand.
Oh, MVL was there. I don't think I've ever heard about that, or I
Yeah,
don't
I don't know
simply
if I've said
remember.
it, but okay, it's not a secret, obviously.
Okay.
And our prep, if you want to even call it prep, was, from what I remember, looking for some ideas in the anti-Berlin, which I actually used in the second round against Anish, our big idea. We missed one move because engines weren't so strong, which he played over the board and immediately got a better position. It was move F6 in some position. People who are interested can look up the game. F6, black is slightly better. That was the end of our prep. So whatever we spent there, like, immediately refuted over the board by Anish. Then we prepared some lines of the Grünfeld. I actually played one line against Anish again, the famous game where I was down four pawns and somehow drew the game.
I remember
At
that.
some point, just like plus five out of the opening. So that was our other prep. Dead loss out of the opening. And our other big thing that we were preparing was the Benoni. I don't think we really looked at any variations. I think I just played blitz games against Maxime and the Benoni. And we decided that this was sufficient prep to play in the Kansas.
Okay, this is really bad.
And I played in one game against Levon and somehow drew that game as well, despite getting probably a losing position out of the opening or close to it. And I don't remember doing much else besides going to the beach a lot and playing a lot of blitz games against Maxime. And what else? I don't quite. Also playing some blitz games against Lawrence, which is fun, and watching movies. That was, but somehow it wasn't so bad. It worked out okay. I almost won the Kansas like
Solid,
that.
yeah, solid.
Obviously, you remember 2018 Kansas prep. That was more serious.
Trying to we had it in Miami, right? Yeah, that was fairly serious. We played some sports, but not that much. We went like
We
once or
didn't play any sports.
twice. I mean, we were playing in the backyard with like the ball
Yeah, we were
occasionally,
jogging. We were jogging a
and we were
lot.
jogging as well. Yeah. And then I think we went a couple of times at the beach, or maybe just once.
Oh yeah, I got horribly sunburned.
Yes, I think all of
Because
us
I
did.
didn't somehow I didn't realize. Okay, over the years I kind of realized that you probably should respect the sun. But at the time I thought, okay, it's like February, right? I mean, what's the worst that can happen? But Miami at midday, whatever day it is, whatever month of the year it is, you'll get really badly burned, especially if you're like pretty white, as I am, if you don't take care. So I got pretty badly sunburned. Do you remember our opening prep though?
I'm trying to remember. What did we do? We did watch some Hikaru. I remember Hikaru was just starting to stream, and we were also following his rise within the streamers world. We had a lot of fun
I
with
don't
that.
remember that at all. I remember the openings that we prepared.
I'm
It was
trying to
actually
remember the openings. Okay, tell me, what did we prepare for the
a
openings?
beautifully concise repertoire, which basically was like, how do you prepare D4 in a week for white?
Oh, I had this idea in the English, I remember.
Yeah, you had this idea, which eventually was played against me by someone, by Grishuk. I mean, it was A3 in a reverse Sicilian line. It was like c4 e5,
That's the only thing I remember about the camp.
g3 knight f6 bishop g2 c6 d4 e4 a3. Okay, this was a line, which Grishuk eventually played against me and got a good position. But it was like, okay, how do you prepare d4 in a week, like everything? And we found out that you can basically play queen b3 against everything. So you play the Catalan, d4 knight f6 c4 e6 knight f3 d5 g3. And then whether black plays bishop e7 now, or first gives a check on b4 and then moves the bishop on back to e7, you always put your queen on b3.
Now I remember this. Yes.
And like looking back, it sounds extremely silly, but I beat Wesley in the first round with this very stupid queen b3. I got a winning position against Ding, it somehow worked like more or less to perfection, this kind of very half-assed prep, which also included queen b3 in the slop. Nobody played the slop, but it was like very amateurish prep if you look back on it, but somehow in 2018 it was good enough. And the rest was like preparing the Petrov with black and the Vienna with black, and openings more or less worked out in that tournament. I mean,
I'm trying to
looking
remember.
back,
Did
it sounds stupid.
you use the Vienna? Ah, yeah, you did use the Vienna. You used it
Yeah,
against Levon, right?
I beat Levon, and yeah, it was the Vienna was solid. I lost in the Petrov to Sergey, obviously, pretty important game, but wasn't the end of the tournament, and somehow I won the tournament, so that went well. And then 2020 was kind of more serious. That was actually like strong engines and real prep and real ideas, and actually used many of the ideas in the tournament. Some are even relevant to this day. And okay, last candidates prep was pretty serious, but play wasn't so good, so it didn't work out. But the prep did over time get more serious, and now we're in a totally different era of prep, and we'll see how that works out as well.
How do you handle the different personalities within a team?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I've worked with many people, and it's not so much about their chess strength because everyone has a different personality. And some people have very strong personalities, like they're stubborn, they might even have like a dominating personality, you might say, right? That they won't back down because there's always going to be some like either chess disputes or some other disputes. And there's some people who are very easygoing and they don't, I mean, I'm not going to say they have like not strong personalities, but they don't let their personality dominate a relationship, or however you want to put it. They're kind of more flexible, which is obviously better when in terms of working together with someone, as long as they're not like wishy-washy and they don't give their opinion or they're scared. In terms of like people with strong personalities, actually most chess players are pretty stubborn,
They are, yes.
but some are a bit more low-key. Like I worked with Mickey, for example. Very mellow guy, very easygoing. I mean, he's obviously going to give his opinions about chess and give like very worthwhile feedback and so on. But it's unlikely that you're going to get into a conflict with Mickey. And okay, I had obviously long-term work relationship with Rustam, so that was many years. So obviously that was complicated at times and good at times, obviously. And we worked together quite a bit as well. Worked with Lenier, for example, also similar to Mickey in some ways, like mellow, kind of chill, relaxed personality.
Yeah, very strong player, very strong analytical force. But
Like,
again, as you were mentioning, very mellow as well.
yeah. I mean, it's some people. I don't want to say too much about people. Obviously, it's like personal stuff very often about how they are. But in general, most chess players I've worked with, yeah, pretty easygoing. Some are like very entertaining. Like we mentioned, Lawrence, obviously, very entertaining guy. So if you want like a fun personality around, you could also look for that. That's always a good thing to have. Someone who will like lighten the mood a bit. And yeah, it's interesting. Of course, you have to manage people sometimes,
You definitely
which is
do.
not my forte. But people want direction, so it's not like you just say, okay, go be free and
I
do what you
generally
want.
think you're pretty good at managing people, especially like after a while. After a while of working with them, because you have like a quiet, let's say, leader's perspective, not like a, a super boisterous leader or anything of that nature, but people generally follow your lead, I would say, especially once they get to work with you a little bit.
Yeah, the more you work with someone, usually the easier it gets to find a rhythm, if you want to put it like that.
No, I've had a lot of fun during the camp. I was a little bit sick, that was the problem. And you obviously have to manage these type of situations as well, because oftentimes somebody Let's say you have four or five guys on a team, somebody's going to get sick at one point. It was the case in Miami right now. I got sick and I wasn't able to work out for a few days. But you guys kept going. We're not going to mention names of who was there, maybe after the candidates, but you guys kept going and I rejoined, let's say, during the last 5 days or so. So I think overall it went well.
Yeah, getting sick is unfortunate. I was also worried I was getting sick at some point, but somehow avoided it. So immunity stayed strong and avoided whatever.
There was definitely sort of something running around. There was definitely something running around, for sure.
Well, it's also that sort of season, I guess. So the weather's a bit colder. People are going to be more inside. And maybe their immunity will be down a bit and they're more likely to catch something.
Yeah. Hikaru was saying at some point that he's not getting ready for the candidates, I think. I'm not really sure if he mentioned it on his stream, but I've heard about it. What's your take on that? I mean, we because right now, you know, we're saying something and then people are saying that they never said that particular thing. So, you know, I don't want to get into that territory too much.
But there's nothing to get in. Like, okay, if I see something online, someone says something publicly, then I'm, and I say it, I mean, there's not really much to say. Like, what do you say publicly? You have to think about what's being said. But like, people will obviously notice that you said it if you say it. I mean, like, we're obviously talking about the Hans post, right, on Twitter. But it's like, no, I had this moment of like, did I really hear? I was sure I heard it. It was like very vivid memory. But it was like, okay, I don't know. I mean, I didn't save the video. But I was pretty sure I remembered it. Of course, it's not like he said something which is some.
No, it's a minor thing. I mean, it can happen. A slip of the tongue. Yeah, it can always happen.
Yeah, of course. It was like, to me, it was just funny. Like, okay. I mean, he said he's going to be the first American world champion. Obviously, it's funny because it can't be the case. And if it's meant as a joke, it's also funny. I mean, if you say a joke and people repeat it, it's like, isn't that the whole point? Like, you can say we're laughing with him in that case. But I wasn't trying to be mean-spirited in repeating that he said it. It's like, I don't judge you based on some small thing that you said, which wasn't entirely true. Or, I mean, okay, in this case, obviously not at all true. But it just seems sort of funny because it was like there was this obviously ongoing beef, you can call it, with Hans and with Hikaru. Because, okay, there was a lawsuit and all that. So, and then he made a comment basically saying that he's going to be the one who popularizes chess. So it sounded pretty funny. And I remember watching it because it was like one of Hans's coming back streams.
Come back streams, yeah.
What do you want to call it? The
hiatus.
Reconciliation between all the parties, if you want to call it that. And okay, I was watching, I forget which tournament it was, some online event, could be any, right? There's a million of these events. And yeah, it was just funny. But then to claim that you didn't say it, it's like, okay, if it's on video, probably it's someone's going to remember it, right? So anyway.
No, it's funny because I mean, he was giving me a hard time during Mexico as well when we're chatting in Mexico, and he was really telling me that, yeah, I never said that, you know, I never said that. And then, you know, the clip resurfaces, and maybe he just simply didn't remember saying it. And, you know, I'll give it to him. Maybe he just doesn't want people to have that impression of him. Different people have, you know, different understanding of how others will interpret what they say. So if that's his choice, that's his choice. But yeah, he definitely
okay, but
said
it's
it.
Like it's a non-issue, no?
Definitely mean. Said yes, that's the thing. But some people, you know, perceive it differently, I guess. It's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, like, I've said a million stupid things in my life. So have you, I
Yes.
assume, and so
Yes,
has everyone. And so, yeah, you say something like mildly stupid, you can kind of poke fun at yourself for it. You're like, oh yeah, of course, I'm going to be the first American world champion. I'm going to go back in time, and you can just make it a funny thing and kind of keep it lighthearted. There's no reason to double down. But okay, whatever. That's basically, I don't take it too seriously, to be honest.
So I think Hikaru was the one that mentioned he's not going to get ready as much for the candidates, and I think he mentioned why as well, mostly because he previously was taking it very seriously, doing a lot of camps, doing a lot of trainings, and then things weren't working out during the actual event, and then when he didn't take it as seriously, things did work out. So, different styles, I guess, in preparation as well. I think Vidit just recently had an interview, let's say, with Anish. They let Anish ask Vidit a couple of questions during Tata Steel, and he did say that he hasn't started his camp yet, and he doesn't know exactly who his trainers will be. But I guess that's normal. It's only January. He has a big event, obviously Tata Steel, and probably immediately after he's done with it, he's going to go get ready for the canvas.
Yeah, everyone will do whatever work they feel is necessary. I mean, we all have our own process, so it's not like you work super hard to guarantee something, and it's not like you don't work at all and it means that you're doomed. It's probably overall for most people a benefit to put some effort into training before, and that's what most people, pretty much all chess players, will go for.
But it's interesting,
And
right?
so.
Because every single other sport, at least, let's say basketball, there's a very standardized way in which you prepare. You just show up in the gym, you do your drills, and then you go back home, and then you repeat that every single day. I don't think there's anything super particular that you do in preparation for, let's say, the Olympia. Like, what is the US team doing differently than what they're doing whenever they're practicing with their NBA squads? Like, it seems there's a standardized model of training. And in chess, I don't know if we have that. Do we have that?
Okay, you can say that most people will do something similar. So, like what you see at the Magnus camp will look very much like what we do, with some differences, some minor differences, but more or less you're getting the same sort of. And Jan will do the same thing, right? It's you invite a bunch of people and you look at chess. The thing is that, of course, when it comes to like basketball or any of these big sports with a lot of money, it's very much down to a science. Like there's a lot of money and research that goes into it. And in terms of chess, most players don't make much money and don't have the means to invest. Like I have to say, the camp that I organize is very expensive. It's tens of thousands of dollars. So most players don't have this money to throw at training. And when it comes to, of course, other sports, we're not talking about tens of thousands. We're probably talking about, you have a chef and you have a personal masseur or masseuse, and you have a nutritionist, and you have a psychologist, and
Millions of dollars.
you have a chiropractor, and then you go to sauna, and it's like every day, every part of the day is regimented, and every like they throw who knows how much money right at every single athlete, so it's just the money is different, so the level of professionalism will be different,
Do you think that
but.
we can increase, let's say, the level of productivity through that, through more resources in chess and in chess training specifically?
Well, it's an individual thing. Of course, every player can, but when it comes to like basketball, right? It's the team who is going to invest all this money into their players. But when it comes to chess, we don't really have teams so much. We have individual players. Team events usually have no money and limited funding. Like, okay, the biggest one is the Olympiad. But most players who go to the Olympiad to play for their country get paid absolutely zero or very close to it. And even the big teams like the American team gets paid like a fraction of what I get paid for normal tournaments. So I'm mostly going there to represent my country, not to get paid. I mean, I think our when we won the gold medal, our bonus was like $3,000. That was to win. That was
that's a bit rough. I'm not gonna lie.
Okay. So of course, some countries have bigger rewards.
I think Armenia has like 30,000, or at least those were, let's say, the speculations back then.
Sure, and like Uzbekistan, we heard that they got paid quite a bit for winning. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about most countries, like I don't know, the German team, for example, what do they get paid? Probably very minimally. I remember what Italy was paying. It was nothing. I mean, to play for the team. And okay, so obviously there's no like big infrastructure. So it's very much up to individual players. Now, if you have a lot of money to invest, like let's say you're Magnus Hikaru, you can spend a lot of money because you have it. Then I'd say it's probably worth it. It's probably a good investment. And also there's probably a lot of things that you can do to give yourself a little bit of extra edge, especially a physical edge,
mm-hmm.
like investing in nutrition, investing in exercise, investing in, let's say, different sports routines, whatever might be beneficial. I think but it's always going to be at the very, very top level because we're not like tennis players. We don't get 60 million a year in endorsements. It's, you know, chess players, the top ones get a few hundred grand a year.
Yeah.
Otherwise, most are making an average living or below average. And then Magnus will make, you know, over $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And Hikaru makes most of his money from streaming. So you can't even say that it's like a special case.
Yeah, he's not doing it from chess playing. Let's see. He's doing it from chess.
Yeah, other he makes good money from chess playing, right? He probably made last year like $500,000 from prizes, maybe. Sure. I don't know exactly. But which is very good, of course. But most of his money will be from streaming.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, even for you, and I don't necessarily want to speak for you, but you only have training camps for candidates and World Championship matches, right? I mean, anything else you're doing camps for?
I had one before the World Cup, but it was only about 6 days long.
Okay, and the World Cup, which is a qualifying event for the candidates.
Well, I really wanted to qualify for the candidates.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even do anything before the World Cup. But I was like, okay, we need to amp up the training a little bit. And this is a big event. It ended up being
working out,
right? It was an investment.
Yeah.
So I worked with two guys 1 week, a bit less than 1 week, I guess. Actually, the camp ended up being a disaster for totally uncontrollable reasons. Yeah. I got a really serious infection on my arm. I had never had this before. My arm, my elbow ballooned up for like the next month. It was incredibly painful. Some sort of infection, right? And I didn't want to take antibiotics because I think that antibiotics really mess with you,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like mess with your body. So I was just kind of sitting there in pain and eventually like trying to alleviate it with like hot packs, like hot towels and stuff. And anyway, that's not
and really. I think that's actually kind of unpleasant for a chess player because you're posting up on your elbows whenever you're thinking about the position. I mean,
I couldn't do that.
How
I couldn't
do you
do that
think?
For 2 months.
Yeah.
I couldn't touch that elbow for 2 months. It was really bad.
Yeah. That's crazy. But in the end, everything worked out just fine. Cool. All right. Let's get back to reality. Let's get back to the present day. We have the Tata Steel tournament, Anish stealing pawns, Anish taking my job as an interviewer as well. A lot of things are happening. And of course, Hans is in the mix as well in the Challengers group. So let's talk about that. First time in a long time, I guess, in a big tournament in which both world champions, the women's world champion and the Open world champion, are playing in the same event. Juan Jun and Ding Li Ren. What's your take on that? How do you gauge Juan Jun's performance up to this point? Is she rising to the expectations?
Okay, so let's see the standing. So So far, it's after 10 rounds, so they have three more left.
Yes.
Murderbeck and Gukesh tied for the lead.
Yes.
With plus three, is that, I think I'm reading that correctly.
6.5 out of how many rounds so far?
So that's plus three?
Plus three out of 10, I guess, yeah.
And, Wen Jun, so obviously women's world champion. She beat Faruja in this tournament, probably her biggest win, I would say.
Yeah.
In her career. Highest rated, by at least if we're measuring it by rating, and she's currently on 4 out of 10. So okay, she's the world champion, right?
Minus two, yeah, that's not that bad actually.
She's not a new name. It's we know that she's very strong. She's even been quite significantly higher rated than she is now.
I would say she's very underrated right now.
Well, yeah, there is this whole like deflation thing, so it's hard to judge, right? Because everyone's going down. And it seems like the whole kind of chess eco system has gone down in rating.
Mm-hmm.
But she was at some point, I think, like 26-10 around there. And now she's 25-49. Okay, so big win against Faruja. I think that she could have, today, she could have maybe beaten Parham. She was kind of close, but okay, it ended in a draw. So overall, it's pretty good. Like, she's obviously going to struggle in this field. I mean, she's very much lower rated than most players. She's only like kind of close to, let's say, Max Warmerdam, but many players, she's around 200 points lower rated, so she's going to struggle. But minus two is not like a huge struggle. It's a respectable result. It's also the same exact result that Ding Liren has.
Yep. And Max Warmerdam. So I think she's gaining some rating points. So definitely overperforming for her rating in this one.
Okay, but Max, I mean, if we're being honest, man. Here, the guy is probably very upset with his result.
Oh my
because
goodness.
If we just rewind like 26 hours, I don't know exactly how many hours, but let's say 26.
Yeah,
he was on 50%, and he was absolutely about to beat Parham.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have put him plus one, a half point out of the lead. And he lost that game because he blundered rook c8, I assume, and it went from basically winning to losing within the span of two moves. So that was kind of tragic.
Mm.
And then today, the exact same story repeated. He was totally beating Noderbeck. And if he had won, he would be back on 50%. But he lost both of those games from winning positions. If he had won both, he would be like half a point out of the lead, tied with Anish, tied with Prague. And instead, he's minus two and he's near the bottom.
Yeah.
So that just shows how fine the line is between a good tournament and a disappointing one.
No, absolutely. And he's actually been playing great chess. I mean, obviously he's done a lot of preparation for this event, but it's those slim margins that always make a huge difference, whether you have a good or a bad tournament. And things are just simply not going his way in this one. But definitely, Noderbeck is showing that last year's performance was not a fluke. He almost won it last year, lost it in the last round. He was definitely primed to win the event, but right now, once again, back in not sole position, because Gukesh is also doing amazing, but tied for first with Gukesh, 6.5 out of 10. So both of these youngsters, honestly, having amazing
Noderbeck
tournaments
has a much easier finish.
Okay, so he's finishing up with what? Vidit.
Okay, obviously Vidit is a top player.
Jiwenjun.
But he's playing Wenjun and Donchenko.
Yes.
So two of the lower rated players in the tournament.
Yes.
And Gukesh is playing Prague, I think. And Alireza and Parham. So three of the higher rated players in the tournament.
Yes.
So, and okay, there's some guys who have a chance as well. Prague, very solid. He's playing Gukesh. He's playing Alireza and he's playing Donchenko. So okay, he has a shot. Anish playing Warmerdam, Max, and Jordan.
Okay, Jordan is struggling.
And Jan. Okay, it's still a wide open race, but of course I would, if we probably look at the stats, Noderbeck should have some sort of decent chance of winning.
Yeah.
And some of the other players also have a decent chance. But probably that everyone who is below Prague and Anish, they're at 6 points plus two, doesn't really have much of a chance. I mean, 5.5, 1 point gap with three rounds to go, probably not going to really cut it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this group includes like Jan plus one, Alireza plus one, Wei plus one, so on and so forth.
Yeah, no. But obviously, looking at the standings, I don't know when it happened, but I can easily say right now that these guys more or less stabilized, let's say, their presence in the top, cemented their presence in the top. Nodribek, Gukesh, Prague as well, all of these youngsters that not long time ago, in fact, probably when we first started the podcast, which was a little bit over a year, we were talking about, okay, who's going to be the next big thing? It seems like all of them are the next big thing. They're definitely making their way to cement themselves into the new generation of elite level players. Would you say so?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's pretty clear that they're very strong.
Yeah.
And if they're a bit behind some of the more well-established players, it's only by a tiny bit.
Yeah.
It's definitely not a clear margin. And but Nodribek,
they're here to stay.
Yeah, of course. Nodribek, Gukesh, Prague, these will definitely be top players for a long time to come. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we can talk about other young players, but we've already talked about them very often, right? I mean, we talked about the Indian juniors. We talked about Alireza many times, about Nodribek, and about even some of the younger guys. But yeah, for sure. I mean, there's no, I mean, it was already clear, but there's not really much of a doubt. And if you look at the ratings, like Prague is 27.49 and Giri is 27.55. Alireza is 27.56. Wesley is 27.57. It's not much of a difference.
Nope. Not at all.
Nodribek is 27.43. Very close.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So who's, who would you say out of the candidates right now is making the strongest impression in Tata Steel?
But does it, I mean, does it really matter?
Because
when I won the candidates in 2018, I had a miserable Tata, like minus three.
Terrible, yeah.
When Karjakin won the candidates in 2016, he had a miserable Tata. I don't know exactly, minus three or minus four. And when Jan won in 2022, he had a miserable Bucharest tournament, minus one or minus two, I forget. And so it's like, it's a whole different, I mean, the slate is wiped clean. It's all new.
Even when last year, right? Ding didn't have a great Tata Steel and then went on to win the World Championship, the candidates and the World Championship match. Not the candidates.
Ding. I mean, looking at Ding's chess in this tournament, it's obviously, something's not quite right with his play.
Yeah.
He plays at a level that is far below what I'm used to seeing from him. And he has for quite a while, to be honest.
Like, yeah.
I mean, I hope he recovers at some point, but this tournament is not looking very good for him. He's minus two. His play today was not good. He won one good game against Gukesh. But besides that, it's actually been like all either uninspiring or just bad games.
Yeah, uninspiring, I think it's a good word for it. I don't know. It doesn't feel like he plays a tenacious brand of chess. The type of chess that we've seen from him very, very often. Whenever he's at his best, he's very, very tenacious. I just simply don't see that with Ding right now. But, you know, I mean, all of these things can happen. People can have, you know, difficult periods of time in their respective careers. But yeah, we're hoping to see Ding maybe play a little bit more, you know, because he hasn't been playing a lot. I don't know if you can expect to just come back, play one, two tournaments per year, and then just do amazing in those one, two tournaments that you're playing. It just doesn't happen that way. And it seems to be the case with Ding at the moment.
But I have to say, like, ever since 2019, I actually consider, like, his play to have dropped off very significantly.
Mm.
This is purely not from a results point of view. just like looking at his actual games very often. Like in 2019, I feel like he was incredibly, incredibly strong.
Yeah.
And he won the Grand Chess Tour. And okay, it wasn't like he was, let's say, head and shoulders above anyone else. But he was really strong at a period when it was pretty competitive. A lot of players were coming up. Mm-hmm. And that was the last time that I would say that he was like playing really strong brand of chess. Pretty much. Like he's had some decent results. I mean, he did win a world championship match. But I mean, if you look at the match, of course, it's clear that neither player was. And this is taking in, like, I understand the pressure that goes into it. This is taking into account the pressure and the stress, and we can't understand how difficult it is. It's obviously more difficult.
Well, you can.
Yeah, but still, it's like, unless you're actually in there, you can't really speak for the players.
Yeah.
But you still expect them to maintain, like, a certain quality level, even when the stress is high. And if we look at, what was it, game 12, I think, this is like a quality level which of the match, I mean, of the Ding Yan match. This is a quality level which you can't really expect from a classical chess game between players of that level. It's just, maybe it happens like once in a blue moon, but that was kind of like shocking quality. Mm-hmm. And okay, sometimes I play really shockingly bad games too, so I know how it is. Yeah. But actually, that game was pretty special in terms of how bad it was.
Yeah, yeah. Moving on to...
Go ahead. No, it's just interesting. Because, of course, both of these players will have, like, very different emotions coming out of the match, right? Yan and Ding.
Yeah.
And you would think that for Ding, it would be, like, an inspiring moment. But it doesn't seem to have been, like, getting the ultimate title in chess.
Absolutely.
It doesn't seem like it inspired him.
Yeah. No, no. And I mean, it's a very good point because generally Magnus, for example, after a world championship match, he generally plays very, very well in the ensuing months. Combination of obvious confidence boosting and then also the preparation that he has from that match. It doesn't seem to be happening with Ding right now. Yan, on the other hand, as we've seen even today against Ding, he had some residual ideas, it seems like, from the match, this G4, in the game that I think they played in their last game during the World Championship match, in the same line, the same variation. So definitely showing something, some moments of inspiration, Yan, that is. Okay, let's move on to the challengers, in which I have to say, surprisingly, it's Marc-Andrea Maurizi, one of the, let's say, lower rated players in the event, 2572 going into this one, who's for the moment dominating. I think he has +5, lost game 1-6, and he's been on fire. The world junior champion, only 16 years of age, very promising player from France. What's your take on him? Have you been following his games? And then we also got to talk about what's happening with the other players.
The other players. Of course, you're referring to all the players and not just any specific
players. I'm referring to Liam Vroilic and Jamie Santos and one Hans Moke Niemann, of course.
No, I think, okay, so it's definitely two players who can still win the tournament. Basically nobody else. I mean, it's like, okay, Maurizi, good chance. Mm-hmm. Best chance.
1 point in the lead, 1 point ahead in the lead.
And Danka has a chance, but okay, it's a 1 point deficit, 3 rounds to go. But okay, you definitely can bridge that gap.
Things can happen.
And besides that, probably nobody else is catching Maurizi. So it's between those two players. I don't think anyone else is going to make it.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say maybe 1.5 points. It's possible. If things go really well, you win 3 games in a row. Things could happen. But it's not so likely.
Yeah. And Maurizi has, very good. What, Daniel Darda to play. Irvin Lamy and Liam Vroilic.
Actually, so, maybe a more difficult finish than like Mendonca has.
Mendonca has Salem.
Hard to say, actually. Hard to say.
Mustafa Yilmaz was very close to winning it last year, but this year he's just simply having a disastrous tournament. And Divya Deshmukh, who obviously, you know, wasn't one of the rating favorites. She was actually at the bottom of the rating totem pole, 24-20. But she's been winning some very cool games, actually. I remember that game. I think she beat Korobov, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, she's
very nice fashion.
I think Divya lost to Korobov.
Did she?
She
beat somebody in a very aggressive fashion. I'm trying to remember exactly who.
Santos Latasa.
Ah, yes, you're right. Santos. Mm-hmm.
Okay, she's a very good junior player. She's like, I don't know exactly, 18, I think.
18, 24, 20. Very promising player. Very talented attacking.
I remember like a few years ago, I was kind of, I think it was like what was the tournament? The Grand Swiss in Riga. So we were kind of locked in, but at some point, Surya Ganguly,
mm-hmm.
he's trying to organize some like board games and card games.
Yeah,
and so he invited me, and I ended up playing card games with like all the Indian kids.
Okay,
it was like Avalon, and I think it was only Avalon we played.
Yeah,
and all of these like young, talented Indian kids were there. Divya was among them, and like now some of them are top players, right? So back then they weren't quite top players yet. They were still kind of trying to climb up the ranks. But kids like Prague and so on, and they're all very talented for sure. So yeah, she's good. Ilene Robers is also okay. She's struggling, but she did win two games in a row against top seeds in the tournament. And
yeah, she beat Hans and Mustafa.
Yeah,
back to back.
But since then, it's been a bit downhill. So she lost a few games.
Yeah,
and what else? I mean, it's an interesting tournament. I'm not following it as closely as the Masters group, but still following the games. And Maurizi, he's a world junior champion, right? So he is.
Yeah. He's an interesting.
He's a known talent already.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to see how this guy develops. He doesn't seem to be afraid of anybody. Like he plays very aggressively. He plays very precise for the most part, and it doesn't seem like tension gets to him as easily. At the same time, and I think we were discussing it. When we were discussing the Grand Swiss as well from this year, he can be on and off, as you know, you would expect from a 16-year-old, but definitely a promising talent from France. And of course, Hans, 5.5 +1 right now. Just announced that I think he's not going to lose any more games. I think this was his recent announcement. He announces a lot of things, but his most recent announcement is that he's done losing. Not going to lose any more games.
It's a good announcement.
Yeah.
Okay. See how it works out for
you. Do you dare to announce that you're never going to lose any games anymore?
No, I know I'll lose games. But yeah. I actually don't. Like. I'm not good at not losing games, but I do actually have a style that like leads to a lot of wins and losses, which is overall maybe not such a bad thing.
No, that's actually what he said during his first social media on Substack, first post. He was like, dare to win, dare to lose, more or less. So, you know, he's very inspirational right now. Hans has a new growing YouTube channel, YouTube presence. So it should be interesting to see how the next few tournaments develop for him as well.
Yeah, we'll see.
Cool. All right. What else should we be chatting about? Well, we should definitely chat about another up-and-coming YouTuber, Vladimir Kramnik. He started his Title Tuesday career. Been playing and streaming and speaking with the chat, engaging with the chat, and obviously accusing a lot of people of unruly things. What's our opinion on that? You actually just recently had a launched episode on a different podcast, and you said that you're generally playing two cheaters on average per Title Tuesday. I feel Vladimir probably thinks he's way higher than that. What do we think of that? What's there to say? What's there more to say about what, you know, this crusade that Vladimir is engaged in? Maybe, you know, for a good cause.
Okay, so it's, anyway, this is a cheating discussion. This is not a Kremnik discussion, right?
Yeah.
So, because of course what Kremnik's actual blitz games and his tournament, it's not particularly interesting with all due respect. I mean, he's a good player. He was one of the greatest of all time. Now he's just a good player, with all due respect, again.
Yeah.
And in terms of online chess, of course, he's not that impressive with the mouse, if we're being honest.
Right.
Put it mildly.
Right. Mechanical. But he is still a mechanical good player. Issues, yes.
Yeah. So if we're talking about cheating in general, I don't think I'm going to draw too many conclusions from like the tournaments that that Kremnik is playing. I haven't watched his game so much. I can tell you, and I've said this many times, that cheating is a serious problem.
Yeah.
And yeah, we can of course
get. I mean, we all played Title Tuesday during the camp, and I don't play this very often, just for the simple fact that, you know, I don't see myself having huge chances of winning a prize, and I have better things to do for the most part. But we did play, all of us, and I did feel that my first game was very, very, very suspicious. I played a few more games after that and then decided to withdraw. But the first game was extremely, extremely suspicious. I was already, you know, feeling like I'm joining the Kremnik camp and I'm ready to make some public announcements. But
well, yeah. What I've absolutely noticed among active chess players who I've spoken to, with an absolute 100% accuracy, every single one of them thinks cheating is a serious issue. I haven't spoken to a single one, and I can just like rattle off names, but I don't think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the best players in the world. I'm also talking about grandmasters who are like 2650, grandmasters who are 2600, players who aren't so active, but still play every once in a while online. Everyone I've spoken to thinks that cheating is a serious issue, and the extent of the cheating issue varies. Now, I'm just explaining this for the people who aren't professional players. So people who are watching this, most people won't be in the chess scene as a player, right? They'll just chess enthusiasts and so on. So I promise you might think Kremnik's paranoid, I'm paranoid, or whatever. And definitely many people rightly consider Kremnik's methodology, if you want to call it methodology, to be completely wrong, which I think is also correct. Like, the numbers that he's looking at are not really relevant. So he's right in principle. But it's not just Kremnik. It's not just, Maxime had a podcast with Kremnik. I can tell you that Maxime also will publicly say that cheating is a big issue. Mm-hmm. And it's not just Maxime. It is other players. And it's not just Magnus. And it's not just concerns about certain players. It's actually very widespread concern about many players. And none of it is provable because we can't know for sure. And if I were to cheat tomorrow, you would never know for sure.
Yeah.
And even the players who have been banned, very often they argue their case or they say they haven't cheated. And very often we don't even know who's been banned because it's never or almost never made public. It's never public information. Mm-hmm. The only case that was like made public really was the case that, I mean, okay, we obviously we know, right, what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So that's like one case out of hundreds, right, of people who are actually caught and banned and then maybe argue their case or maybe they admit to it. And we're not talking about, let's say, a limit that stops at a certain rating like 2600. No, we're talking about above 2600, and it also doesn't stop at 2700. We're talking above 2700, and the question is, does it stop above 2750? And I'm actually not sure that it does stop above 2750. And it has nothing to do with elitism, because I think that although cheating is more noticeable if you see a difference in results, like let's say if a 2400 suddenly starts playing like a 2700, that doesn't mean that a 27 plus 100 player who suddenly becomes a 2720 player, we don't actually know for sure if that, it's just harder to detect. It's harder to notice because the skill level is higher at the start, but that doesn't mean that those players should be immune from suspicion. And there's many other things. I think the main thing is the difficulty in actually using any sort of like statistics to reach a conclusion. And the other problem is that how can you really protect against it? I mean, you have to, well, you can't catch someone red-handed. I mean, unless they're a complete idiot, right? they should have been cheating on camera.
It happened. So,
sure, it could happen. But for the most part, people are not going to cheat in a way that you'll actually catch them red-handed online. So you have to decide based on what? That's actually for me the biggest question. For Kramnik, he decided that it's based on chess.com accuracy scores. So I think that that's honestly bogus.
Yeah. That's not a good metric. Actually, he loses.
Some people will say,
in a lot of people's eyes, he loses credibility because he uses that metric so dominantly, which is probably not a great metric.
And I don't think that it means anything. I can show you like some of my games and ask you if the chess.com accuracy meant anything in this game. But then the question is, okay, what do you use? We don't know what chess.com uses because obviously their algorithm or whatever is a secret.
Yeah.
And so do we use results? Like if someone is playing badly over the board but playing really well online, do we use that? Because if we use that, then some people like really do come to mind. Do we use the amount of money that people have won? Because if we use that, then obviously top players are the ones who have won most of the money. But you can also see people who have won like $0 over the board, but who have won pretty substantial amounts, maybe 50,000 plus over the years in chess.com events. And people were like shocked by my, like, some players have won hundreds of thousands of dollars. Well, there's actually like many players who have.
Yeah.
So again, I'm not saying that, like I won hundreds of thousands of dollars on chess.com, but there's serious money involved. So if someone's cheating, and I really doubt that all the players who have won significant amounts of money have always done so fairly. I'm pretty sure that's not the case.
Yeah.
Of course, without proof. So I can't prove that this is the case, but nobody can. And the other question is, like, it's not my responsibility to ban or not ban someone.
Yeah.
But chess.com or Lee Chess or whatever has to decide what their percentage
threshold,
of certainty,
I guess.
Yeah, what their threshold is.
Threshold of banning people. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, no. How sure do they have to be? Like Kramnik will tell you maybe it's 90%. For me, this seems kind of not certain enough, right? Because we might be getting into territory where, you know, some players get banned without reason, but they're also very strong players and it's their living. And I think the difference with, like, okay, so once we spoke to Vladimir and he mentioned the parallel between chess cheating as a crime and like real world crime. The difference is that when you have a real world crime, you need some sort of physical evidence usually, right? Like you're not deciding based on numbers on a screen, like how accurately someone played, how well someone played in the game. It's like, okay, the person was in this location, their fingerprints were there, or someone saw them, or okay, now we're just talking about different things, right?
Beyond reasonable doubt, yes, I guess.
Or something, like something tangible. Like when it comes to online chess, it's so difficult. I can't even imagine. I mean,
what is the reasonable doubt, I guess, in this instance?
Well, I don't think you can base it off moves because some, like, if I want to cheat, I can cheat by playing like shit and win. Or I can play a really, really good game and not be cheating, like really accurate. I think the thing is that when you cheat, you can also control the you can control the direction of the game. So you can make the position such that it's super, super complicated so that mistakes are likely to happen. And then you can just like start making mistakes yourself, and your opponent's making blunders, and you're making blunders. And at some point, you just capitalize on a blunder and you win. Or you could just do it by like just playing yourself for the most part, but you play very, very quickly because you know that if you get in trouble, you can always bail yourself out. You can also decide that you only want to cheat, one game every two Title Tuesdays. It will increase your results just a tiny bit. But it will make a strong player a very strong player, and it will make a very strong player an elite player, and so on and so forth. You can also say that you'll only cheat in two games every Title Tuesday, and you'll only consult the engine twice in those two games at random moments. It's going to increase your results somewhat. It is cheating, but how will you possibly be able to know? And
You
I mean, there's just like a million ways. We
you
don't
won't
even
know.
understand how. So, for me, the most important thing for people to understand is that chess players are just humans, and they're going to be tempted like anyone else. If I leave my door to my house open, and I leave on a vacation for a month, do I really expect that nobody is going to come and steal something?
Well, if nobody knows that your door is open, then probably nobody's going to try it. You have a high chance of nobody trying
Well,
it,
I mean,
just for the simple
if I
fact that
leave
they
my
don't
door
know.
wide open
Oh, that's
and I just
over.
leave,
Yeah, that's over. Yeah,
yeah.
you
No, I'm
go
just
out
saying
for
that
like an hour. Bye-bye.
if we give opportunity to people, then in almost all cases, chess or non-chess, people will, some people, not all people are going to take advantage, but some people will be tempted and will take advantage for their own benefit.
Yes, yeah,
And it would be
especially when
very
it
naive to
comes to
assume.
financial benefit, especially when it
Yeah.
comes to one's living ability to put food on table. People do all sorts of things for that.
Yeah, it would be very naive to assume that that I host a chess tournament where cheating is both easy, very low risk in terms of being caught if you're smart, and also financially rewarding, and that nobody will take advantage of it. And we have a tournament of, I don't know, 200 players, whatever it normally is. I don't actually know the numbers of how many people play Title Tuesday. Let me just check the last one. Just check. Let's see. Okay, I'm already way past 200. Okay, way past 300. So now we're in 400s. Okay, 488 players,
Let's
most who
say an average of 400 on the lower ends.
most actually withdraw very quickly after they lose a few games. But yeah, let's say 400 players. And so what percentage do you think will cheat? I don't know. I mean, if we're not assuming that it's like really, really blatant, like 25% is really blatant. I mean, chess.com said 3%, right? But we also, I would assume that they're going a bit low on that. And even if we settle at like 10%, that's still a pretty good chance that you're going to face a cheater at some point in those 11 games. So, okay, I mean, you can call it paranoia or like last Title Tuesday, I don't have strong suspicions I played a cheater. This was like 2 days ago. But I do have like suspicions about one game, which I actually won. But I don't know for sure. I was playing someone like who was absolutely just outplaying me so consistently and then just flagged.
Yeah,
But I don't know
no.
for sure.
It's
So I don't think that it's like I'm not always thinking that people are cheating. But sometimes I have a really weird feeling. Like some people, they just crush me. One player who hasn't played a single over-the-board game in 15 years just played first line to last, first move to last, the first line of the engine, and that player still plays. Yeah. So I don't know. Like, to me, that's even that one game is just impossible. Like, yeah. Okay, maybe Magnus does it.
That doesn't happen. That simply doesn't happen. That actually doesn't happen. Never happens. Especially for somebody
that does sometimes happen, but usually not from players who don't even play chess anymore.
Yeah.
But okay, what can I say? I mean, if people want to think that it's all paranoia, of course they're free to think so.
It's a never-ending story, and I'm sure there is plenty of chapters to come in it. Fabi, it's been great catching up. I think it's time to call it a day. You have some tournaments coming up, but I'm sure we'll chat about it in our next episodes. Guys, don't forget, if you're enjoying the content, if you're enjoying the episodes, the discussions, tell your friends, sub to the channel, turn on the post notifications. That's going to let you know whenever we post new episodes. And yeah, we'll see you guys in the next one. Cheers.